This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's the 30th of October, coming very close, perilously close to the end of the year, just 2 months away before the new year begins. How exciting.
Scary, Lasharat. So fast.
Our time flies, whizzed by this year. Yeah. You know, only yesterday you were a young 21-year-old. Now you're a wizened 40-something.
Knee high to a grasshopper.
Yeah. That's it. That's right, mate. You know, whether it's Yemen or the Rakhine State, now we have Congo and more misery. Apparently, millions could starve in the district of Kasai in the Congo, according to the head of the UN Food Agency. He's warning that some 3 million people are at risk because of conflict there.
Unfortunately, it seems to be that we have larger and larger numbers of people displaced by conflicts, and we're supposed to be, you know, in an era of abundance and so forth. It's really, really sad to see that so many millions are now starving.
Yeah, and of course, abundance is also predicated on resources. Resources become a source of much of the conflict over petroleum or diamonds. And I mean, this is just the tragedy sometimes of great wealth.
Actually, there's one time I read a book called by Jeffrey Sachs, you know, the World Bank guy, right? And he said that one of the biggest social problems in the world, not the biggest, is the misallocation of resources, because in the rich world, there's so much food that goes to waste on a daily basis. Malaysia's included, right? Now, I mean, look at how much we have on Raya and Chinese New Year, right? And then there's so many more millions in...
Yeah, but here's the situation where it's not so much a lack of food, it's really about conflict.
Correct.
Displacing, yeah. Economies and
correct.
Displacing traditional ways of supplying food and such. So that's really, it's the heart of the problem is a political one.
Yeah, but it's kind of all interlinked, isn't it? Because conflict arises because you don't have enough of something.
No, but then again...
you have people that come in and
I don't agree with
dissent.
You there, because a lot of time conflict then, for example, like in Africa, in the Congo, what's it about? It's diamonds. That's the conflict diamonds and the battle over resources that the country actually has, the richest of the country.
Well, more conflict. We're just going to have conflict here in the studio as well, it seems like. Anyway, also on that Me Too hashtag that's going on about sexual harassment, Tom Jones.
Tom Jones was sexually harassed?
Apparently,
really?
In early days, he didn't name the person, but he said he was sexually harassed when he was very young.
Yeah, he was sexually harassed by a man, apparently, during the early stages of his career. So a lot of time, there's not insufficient attention given to the fact that, obviously, men are also victims of sexual harassment.
Yeah, and often by the perpetrators being men themselves.
Yes.
And so let's just get that straight. Really? It's not a reverse, it's not exactly a mirror image.
It's not something that women normally do, isn't it?
Yeah, apparently. So, yeah. Maybe they're just the better of the species. Okay, also, rebuilding is going on in Marawi City. 150 days of battle between government and pro-Islamic State militants. That's claimed over 1,100 lives there and displaced over 350,000 people. Now, the hard job of reconstruction.
Talk about conflict zones, isn't it? But sometimes it's good for business, isn't it? I mean, look at the whole... effort in Japan after the Second World War, their economy went berserk, didn't it?
Yeah, that's because they had some sort of a Marshall Plan, didn't they? We'll be back with more, including whether snails are losing their mind. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That's Queen with Don't Stop Me Now. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Brian Fernandez and Kusu Chung. And the morning run continues. It's coming up to 8 minutes past six on the 30th of October. As promised, we're going to be talking about snails and what's going on with their heads. Apparently, a new study of snail neurons, and not by, but of snail neurons, suggests it's possible to wipe out specific memories in snails. I'm not quite sure how rich the inner life of snails is, but...
Well, you see, snails don't fight back. That's the problem. If you do it on monkeys, they will obviously protest, right? So this is
or human beings. Yeah, but snails... I don't know, maybe snails have their own form of protest at any rate.
Well, they wiggle their radar at you, do they?
The antennae.
Antenna,
yeah, but or they retreat back into their shells. But okay, the important thing is, let me finish. The important thing is, what it is a scientific advance that allows you know, intervention into something that we used to think was so ephemeral, so hard to pin down.
Sacrosanct. Something your mind like, is your own.
Yeah, and memories in specifically, right? So, because, you know, we've had, you know, decades, in fact, centuries of lobotomies, that kind of interventions. But the idea of removing specific memories. Brian, would you want any memories of your own, whether traumatic or happy, well, assuming it's not happy, but traumatic, to be removed?
No, I don't think about myself specifically, but I can see therapeutic applications for people who perhaps, for example, suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. If you can surgically or whatever means remove that memory from them, that's going to have really a big impact in terms of quality of life for those sort of people. So there is a really positive application for this, but I also see a lot of negative applications.
But where would you start, right? Say, for instance, somebody comes out of the Iraq War, the Gulf War, number one, number two, and they are suffering. What specific, would you have to wipe out that whole, all those years in order to wipe out the stress that comes from, you know, having served in that unjustifiable,
well, assuming the same
unjustified war?
Assuming the scientists know and can basically categorize your brain like the contents of a personal computer, where there's folders and subfolders and, you know, drives and stuff like that, you can actually you know, home in and triangulate on a particular area of the brain, which I think they can already kind of.
Really, you think so? I mean, that's quite a big leap from where
you
we are today.
You read The Lancet, do you, Chuang? I mean, is that what do you do?
What is The Lancet?
The Lancet, that, you know, that medical journal,
I
mean,
No. Okay. But this is basically the very early start of conquering the brain, isn't it? Because depends on who gets this power, right? And depends on whether it's Dr. Evil or Dr. Good. Because there's so many ways you can either do good or do bad with
this. This is about implanting memories as well. So that's the next stage as well.
Well, you know, that's a Blade Runner story, right? So in the Blade Runner, the importance that, you know, that is placed on the memories of replicants is that memories, like so much of the way the mind works, is a narrative that allows everything else to hang on it. So your personalities are built on memories.
Yeah.
Now, if you start taking bits out of that narrative, including stuff that's negative. Because the negative is also about learning, isn't it? I mean, a lot of our negative experiences, like, for instance, you're traumatized because you touched a hot pan, you know, but kids learn never to touch a hot pan because they remember the pain they suffered from before.
Correct.
So do you want to take that pain away?
So this is exactly my point. I wouldn't want to take specific memories out of me personally in terms of my childhood, whether negative or positive. However, from a therapeutic standpoint, I really see a huge benefits of this. But I can also see, of course, from a military standpoint or the forces of evil, how you could actually then use this in a negative context.
Yeah, do you see forces of evil around you, Chuang?
I see dead people.
You do.
But in all seriousness, right? The future is there, and it's kind of like visible through the fog, and it's quite Orwellian in nature. And I'm not sure whether I want to welcome it, because I've got this jaundiced in a way view of my, you know, life in the 70s and 80s, when things were so much simpler. And now,
except you know, the 20th century is full of dystopic visions of the future. I mean, you mentioned George Orwell in 1984. I mean, that was written in the middle of the 20th century, with a real understanding that human beings have a capacity to create worlds that might seem simpler, better, whatever, but ultimately hurt us. Like, you know, even from an even earlier period, Brave New World. Right.
So that's
another dystopic vision of the future.
So that's one of the things also in terms of human beings. We seem to have this ability to try to destroy ourselves or each other. So I have kind of a negative view, jaundiced view in terms of the human race as a whole. I still think that I think eventually we will kill ourselves.
You know, I do think that when it comes to talking about the past and you know, negative memories, the best thing to do is to talk it through and redefine your relationship to the past. Rather than erase it, rethink it.
Absolutely.
That's the only way.
I think so too.
Couldn't agree with you more, right?
Okay. Next up, we talk about the damage that smart people can do to their organizations. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me Kusu Chuang and Brian Fernandez. It's just past 18 minutes after 6. And it's the 30th of October. That was the summer of 69 by Brian Adams. Now, we're in an era of low growth when job creation is a kind of a political hot potato. We have a slightly anomalous situation. That is, one of overqualified people in jobs. And one might think on the face of it that this is a good thing, but apparently, according to research, it isn't. Now, I'll give you some statistics that 1 in 6 workers in Britain are thought to be overeducated for their jobs, with 58% of graduates in roles that do not require university degrees. In the US, an estimated 1 in 4 employees with a bachelor's degree is overqualified for their current position. Now, apparently, many employers think this is a good deal. They're getting degree-holding workers. But it's leading to something that experts are calling job inflation, and that this practice might, in fact, backfire on them.
Yeah, so the thing is, it sounds all good on paper, but the reality is, and if you look at it in detail, often the overqualified graduate who's doing a clerical job, for example, very quickly will become disengaged from the job because essentially that's not using the education or the skill sets that the person has. And as a result, you probably have poorer performance from that person moving forward than, say, someone who's less well qualified. However, that person is dedicated to do that job because that's what they can do.
Unfortunately, it's a sign of the times, isn't it? Because unemployment in the developed world is so high. And I've got friends in the UK who do have master's degrees, who do have degrees, and they can't get a job. And those jobs that they're getting, for example, I have a friend who eventually found a job as a salesman of Skoda cars. And he's one of the most intelligent people I know. And he got that job after like a rigorous process where he was up against tons of people. And all he's doing is basically sell cars. And that's in the UK. So it's such a tough market now that you take what you can, but obviously, you know, you're not going to be, you're not filling your job description because you're just too good for it.
Okay, but what is it to be too good for a job? I mean, presumably you can get the task done, but there's the dimension that they're looking at is whether, you know, the fact that you might be bored with that job, that you might start to resent having to do a job or tasks that are, you know, in some sense, beneath you. Is that where the problem begins?
Yes, that is. I think that's one of the aspects, and I touched on that briefly. But also, I think employers sometimes are a little bit, and let's look at the Malaysian context, they may be reluctant to actually hire, the other end of the equation, they are reluctant to hire an overqualified person for a role.
Because they have to pay more.
Not necessarily, even at the same sort of salary band, because they're worried that if I hire this person is using me as a holding pattern. So he or she is going to come in, work with me for a while until he or she gets a better job. So I think that's the flip side of the equation, the negative side of the equation.
But what about the issue of career prospects and advancements within an organization? Now, if you get somebody who's, as it were, overqualified, then the onus on providing some sort of career path for them, it becomes higher, right? I mean, just because people come with certain expectations of where they're going to go in an organization, don't they?
Yeah, well, you see, the thing is, so let's look at that at the following. So let's say we take an overqualified person. That person performs well at a role. You should, as an organization and a progressive organization and progressive bosses, should recognize, hey, this person has a lot of capability and perhaps this person should be either loaded up on more work or then define a career path for that person so that they can take on other jobs within the economy.
Well, that's the ideal, isn't it? That's the ideal, but the naked truth of the matter is that in the UK and other developed countries, you got a job, you need to get a job because you need to put food on the table, and that's it. Career progression is secondary in a way to survival. And that's the truth.
No, it's not true to a lot of the third world where, you know, you have, in fact, very educated people or very smart people who didn't have opportunities for education, who are in jobs that, you know, people might see as menial and such. But they are people who were thoughtful or articulate, but just because of family circumstances, couldn't go to school.
It's a lot more complicated than that because the dynamics in an emerging economy is so different because you're trying to make it happen. You could be a migrant worker, for example. You could be an immigrant, for example. But then,
Think of all those overly educated migrant workers. You think of, Filipino maids. If you watch any documentary about Filipino maids in Hong Kong or Singapore, whatever, all come with university degrees.
The cleaner here who brings in the food and stuff, obviously the girl, right? She's got a degree from Indonesia, right? But she's doing stuff here, right? Do you know what I mean? So It's very different. It's very much more complex and complicated than that.
What would you do if you were you had a field of people? Some people who had a university degree and some people don't, but you have a task that doesn't require that. Would you still hire up? Would you still hire somebody with a university degree rather than not? Because you could use them in many more ways.
And
perhaps.
That's the different complexion here because today's day and age, I mean, for example, Ernst & Young, they don't hire on tertiary degrees anymore. They hire based on your ability to interact with people and your ability to be creative with solutions and your ability to interact with clients.
Yeah, and I think that, and you're right, Truong, especially in a smaller organization where somebody has to multitask, I think that you need to hire for ability rather than academic qualifications.
Okay, next, the Shins with Australia, taking us all the way up to 6:30 in the morning in the first bulletin of the day. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Stevie Wonder with For Once in My Life. If you want to join this conversation, you can always do that on Twitter at us at Twitter at BFM Radio or join us in the conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me Brian Fernandez and Kusu Chuang. Now we'll talk about a proposal to introduce a lifespan policy for cars. And that would include an incentive for car owners to change their vehicles. It's basically a handout to owners of cars to end the life of their cars that are getting, as it were, to the end of this lifespan and to buy a new car. The question is this a good idea?
Yeah, well, so the basic premise of this and the policy basically goes by the terminology of vehicle end-of-life policy. So the argument is basically that there's a lot of, especially in the Malaysian context, there's a lot of old clunkers out there. And if you get them all out of the road from a public safety perspective, that's a good thing because a lot of these cars are not inspected and may not have proper safety equipment, proper brakes and so forth. They also would help from a pollution perspective because older vehicles are much more pollutive than current modern vehicles. The third thing is also the fact that the automotive industry will receive a shot in the arm, definitely, because essentially people scrap their vehicles and then you replace them with newer ones.
But why should the government be spending taxpayers' money? Some of these taxpayers don't own vehicles. But, you know, why should it use taxpayers' money to aid the automotive industry? Why should it get, you know, people to change their polluting, you know, gasoline-guzzling cars if there are already laws that say you can't be polluting the airs, you know, through, you know, with a dirty engine or whatever? Why should taxpayers' money be used for this? I don't get that.
One word, money. People can't afford to buy a new car. There are so many people in Malaysia who want to get a new car but cannot afford the down payment or the installments to buy a new car. And they can't.
Maybe that would be good for our cities. Maybe the idea is not to get people to replace cars, but people to replace their transport habits. You know, once they come to the end of the life of their
you
car,
don't have
junk
MR,
it and go for transport.
You don't have MRT in villages and kampongs
exactly.
And small towns.
We're not talking about villages. We're talking who are going to be the primary recipients of a policy like that. It's going to be the car owners of the cities. Already car owners get huge subsidies for the tolls.
The old guy in Bunting or, you know, basically a pensioner.
Oh, that's sweet of you.
I'm serious.
I know you middle-class people with so many cars are so concerned about rural folk.
Both my personal cars are 25 years old. They both qualify for vintage car status, but I haven't gone that direction yet. But that's true. People cannot afford to buy new cars, and that's why this vehicle end-of-life policy is very good. It depends on the execution.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want a situation where the person who is poor or in a B40
in prison, in another higher purchase again
because they own, maybe it's an old clunker.
So this is the downside of a policy that would force people to give up their old cars and purchase new ones.
And then get on the debt ladder again.
So we don't want that.
So this is the downside. Agree? Yes?
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. So the upside is we have all these other things. Why does it have to come down to cash incentives? Now, that's what I don't understand. Because
people can't afford to buy new cars.
Only that, it may not be a cash incentive, Sharad.
Yeah,
it could be, in fact, a coupon. For example, the government may do a deal with the vehicle manufacturers and says, okay, I'll give you a coupon for five. Each of you have to give out a coupon for 5,000 ringgit so that, or a discount, whenever somebody comes in and drives an old clunker in that's probably worth 1,000 ringgit.
So has the automotive industry lobbied the government for a policy
absolutely.
Like this.
Absolutely. This has happened.
Do you think that's it? So they're benefiting their bottom line at our expense.
Actually, not necessarily, because if you already price a car, for example, say a Prado or Viva, at 35,000 ringgit, and then you're compelled by the government to give a $10,000 or $5,000 ringgit rebate on that car, you're going to make next to nothing on that car by way of margins. But
yes,
this is one of those measures that are going to help all the stakeholders, from the owner to the industry to the government.
Absolutely.
From pollution. So,
that's an interesting way to put it, because that sounds like propaganda. It is.
Okay, but the thing
you
is...
You just said it might get people into a debt
correct,
trap.
Correct, but the thing is how there is a there will be mechanisms in place where, for example, one of the things I would suggest they do is the coupon would be used to then purchase a used car. So then they don't have to get in such a big debt as they would if they were compelled to just buy a new car.
Okay, for example, you know those, when you go to Pasar Malam, right, or you go to any night market, petty trader, you see some of these guys with old Nissan Vanettes. They come, and these cars are 30 years old, 35 years old. They're about, you know, they cost the guy a ton of cash, right? So if you get to get into migrate to a new car, your bills might go down, your cost of ownership might go down. So there's a lot of benefits, honestly.
Okay. Next up, we'll be talking about yet more policy issues. This time, a law, perhaps, that will compel you to visit parents, your old parents, who are placed in healthcare institutions. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Charles Bradley, and the world is going up in flames. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Kusu Chuang and Brian Fernandez. Remember, you can always join us in this conversation. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Next up, we talk about an initiative spoken about it in Parliament by the Kuala Kangsar MP, Datin Mastura Yazid, who talked about the issue of parents in healthcare centres. She said children should be subject to special conditions that include compelling them to visit their parents. She said this was to prevent children from leaving the responsibility of caring for their elderly or geriatric parents entirely to healthcare institutions. To get more insights into this, we spoke to consultant geriatrician Dr. Tan Mao Pin and asked her what her concerns are about this suggestion.
Okay, I personally have concerns about using the law to instill moral values, because at the end of the day, the law should be considered the lower level of ethics. Younger people and also the future generation should not be led to believe that as long as they comply the law, they're doing the right thing, because we should be visiting our parents out of love and desire to actually please them and also to meet them rather than an obligation. You can't obligate someone to meet their parents.
We also ask her, what are the risks of creating a sense of resentment that, you know, we would create a sense of resentment among children if they were legally obliged to visit their parents?
Absolutely, because it's sometimes when you are made to do things, then you don't feel like doing it, you know, because you're being forced to do it. There's a lot of examples, for instance, some of the, even when we were children in school, when we're being forced to learn a certain language or when we're being forced to do things that like PE, then we don't enjoy it. But if left to our own devices, we would actually eventually do it because we know it's good for us.
Well, that was consultant geriatrician Dr. Tan Mao Pin talking about perhaps disincentives or incentives for children to respond to their parents in need, especially their geriatric parents. Several questions that are brought up there by Dr. Tan, including that people should be doing this out of love. But what if you didn't receive much love from your parents and they were nasty, horrible people, because some parents are like that? How would you then get children to respond? I mean, you know, of course they're going to be wanting to abandon their parents in their old age because they maybe feel they were neglected as children.
Yeah, that's such an astute observation, actually, because this is real life. And obviously, one observation is so much more complex and complicated than we think. And it's really a case-to-case basis, because you can't just say it's a blanket rule, oh, kids must visit their parents because it's the humane thing to do. But there's so many more things to it than that.
Yeah, and you see, the other end of the spectrum is if you put in a law to compel children to do that. Now, Singapore has a law called the Maintenance of Parents Act, where you're actually compelled, or the parents, if you're above 60, you can actually compel your children to pay for your maintenance and stuff like that. Now, that has worked, but is that the right thing to do? I think the jury's out on that.
Well, I think it works on this score, right? If the objective of the state is that the state does not want to be burdened financially with the care
of the interest,
then of course it doesn't matter whether you love your parents or you don't love your parents. You come that out, you know, come to them, you know, bearing gifts and flowers and tears in your eyes. All it matters is that you end up paying for them, right? So the abandonment of the geriatric, old, is about a cost issue. And I think in Singapore, it's very clear. I mean, you'd strip away all the other stuff about filial piety and Confucian society and love of the elderly and, you know, the importance of wisdom and all that. Your bottom line is the money that goes into healthcare costs.
Yeah, I just saw a documentary last night, actually from Vice, and it shows that by the year 2050, Japan will be half the population it is now, because kids, young people are not, you know, procreating, and it's a very, very aging, very much an aging society. So it's really, to me, because I'm a parent, right, and it's about managing expectations, because I'm one of those sandwich generations. I've got children below me and I've got parents above me, and we are what the fund managers call the sandwich generation, because we're sandwiched by these two generations.
And that's not a pleasant place to be.
It's not
a pleasant,
financially, it's not.
Financially, no, it's very challenging. So it's a mindset thing, because my parents and maybe parents above them used to think that the more children you have, the more they will look after you when you're older. So you, the more children you should have, then they can kind of like give you an allowance, put a shelter over your heads, etc. Today, parents, they know intrinsically in their heart of hearts that they cannot rely on their children, because A, conditions are very tough anyway, and B, that is not the way they are made up anyway, right? So it is incumbent upon yourself as a sandwich generation person to look after your personal balance sheet. You have to look after yourself. If you can't,
but do you do that at the expense of your kids, though? I mean, do you say
you've got to? No, you've got to balance it out.
You've got to balance it out.
You've got to pay
the day. But it's a trade-off, right? So if the balance means deciding whether to send your kid for a high-quality education overseas or protecting your retirement plan, what would you do?
That is only an answer you can answer. That's the only question you can answer.
And I agree with Chuang, because essentially it's up to the individual. The prudent thing to do, because we are the sandwich generation, is really about protecting yourself and then also then looking after your children's welfare, not just the children's welfare.
Tell us what you think. Tweet us at BFM Radio, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. The question before us is, what do you do with poor, aging parents who are abandoned by their thing? At a societal level, what should governments do? Should they, in fact, institute some disincentives for abandonment or incentives for care?
Well, we just saw in the budget that incentives have been given to fresh parents between 2018 and 2022, because we want to up the population in this country. You're right. It's at the end of the day, it's all about money. But if you have parents, it is your responsibility. You've got to make it happen for your kids. So for me, the balancing act is very important. It's a question we ask ourselves every day. It's a conversation that my wife and I have every day. And at the end of it all, you've got to make it happen for yourself as well as for your kids. I know one particular case where the wife is working as quite a low paying job in an institution, and her husband is working in a hotel. It's quite a low paying thing, and they have made a call to spend all their money, every single dollar of their monthly salary, on one of their two daughters to send her to private school, at their expense to everything else. To me, I'm not sure.
And I think that's a misallocation of resources.
I think so.
And also the difference between the two kids. One kid got chosen and one kid didn't.
The anointed one.
And the psychic hurt that other child's going to carry, or maybe the guilt the other child, the anointed one, will carry. This is such a conundrum. Thank you very much. We got a WhatsApp comment. And I'm going to start with, clearly this person is smart. It says, I agree with Sharad. The car policy aids automakers, dealers, and ruins the environment. Thank you so much. Whoever you are, I know you're at least as smart as I am. taking us all the way up to 7, and the next bulletin, Carnival by the Cardigans. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez and Kusu Chuang. It's coming up to 6 minutes past seven on the 31st. Sorry, the 30th of October. Earlier, we talked about several policy initiatives. One of them being cash for all cars. Now, Terence Kumar has tweeted in, says he agrees with the cash for clunkers policy if he gets at least 30% towards his new vehicle. So that's the level at which I think people feel that'd be comfort, maybe even
from one person.
Really instead, one person. Yeah. So the question again is, why should taxpayers' money go into purchasing private vehicles rather than, say, putting money into public transport and getting people to leave their cars or abandon cars, and create a city that's less congested and less polluted? All these are policy options. Now, we talk about Marawi City. We began with a discussion of the rebuilding of Marawi City, devastated by over 150 days of conflict between the Islamic State and the army of the Philippines government, claiming over 1,100 lives, as well as displacing hundreds of thousands of people. Now, Bukit Aman Special Branch Counterterrorism Division Principal Assistant Director Dr. Ayub Khan Maidin Piche says that teachers and parents need to seriously take the threat of Daesh and understand the traits of militant groups' followers to ensure that its ideology is not spread among school students. And you remember, many Malaysians were involved in the Marawi city siege on the side of the militants, one of them being a former university lecturer from University of Malaya. We spoke to Dina Zaman, founding member of IMAN, a social enterprise focusing on research and community engagement, asked her what her thoughts are on this and who she thinks should be educating the educators.
I think there needs to be a very holistic strategy when it comes to this, yes? I think the police should be working with the Ministry of Education, but also supported by civil society organizations or researchers to actually study violent extremism or terrorism. It cannot be just one party. We all have to work together to educate the teachers. So I don't think there is a right way or wrong way of doing things. Obviously, when you look at educators, they're not being trained. It's probably something that they understand, they know, they read about, but not being trained. How do you tell your students, you know, that you shouldn't be following extremist ideals? When you talk about religion in Malaysia, right, it's basically a no-no, especially when you talk about Islam. So nobody dares, you know, to say there's not the right way or the wrong way. So we should all look at working together. I mean, coming up with modules, talking to the students. But also we need to figure out what kind of Islam do you want to represent?
We also asked Dina if a subject in the current school syllabus could be added to deal with issues like this.
Wow. That's a huge question. I think it's going to be both, right? One, we definitely have to go through our textbooks, yeah? Go through the materials. What are the kids learning now? How can it be made better? That's one. Two, teachers need to be trained. This is the Islam that you're teaching and your students. It should not have any extreme ideologies at all. Then yes, perhaps from time to time, you can get the police or someone, a trainer, to say, look, if you see this kind or you hear this kind of message being uttered or talked about among your friends, think that maybe that's not the way you should do things, because Islam is about moderation. Islam is about peace. But of course, this cannot be done overnight. It's something we all have to work on. And I feel that parents, honestly, I feel a lot of parents now tend to outsource a lot of things to the schools.
Speaking of parents, we asked Dina what the role of parents is in this complicated matter.
When you talk about terrorism or anything that, you know, that disrupts racial unity in this country, parents also have to be engaged in this. You can't expect, you know, your friends, your teachers to take over everything. So parents at home also have to filter and tell the kids, okay, these are the teachers you should be listening to. These are the kind of books you should be reading. Others, yeah, you can read, you can look, but they may not be the right kind of Islam. So parents also have to participate, lah.
That was Dina Zaman, founding member of IMAN, a social enterprise focusing on research and community engagement, engaging with the question of violent extremism and how to reduce the influence of such ideologies. Brian, I want to ask you if a sense of purpose is one of the most difficult things to instill in a child, because I think at the root of this often is the question of the value system of children and what is it they themselves feel they're committed to. And the sense, the notion of a sense of purpose seems to capture that.
And I think, okay, and the answer to a question is quite a tough one, because unfortunately we've got to take it back to the what the parents actually instill in the child in the first place. A lot of the sense of purpose and mission and value systems that children normally have really are imparted, and should be rightly, by primarily by the parents, the grandparents, the extended family, and then only the teachers. But I think she points out one very glaring thing, that a lot of this is now outsourced to the teachers. So you really have a disconnect here with what it should be and what it shouldn't be.
Well, you know,
I mean, this is a broader discussion, isn't it, Chuang?
Such a deep and complex and conundrative.
I love you. Just make up.
Can I just make words up?
Make my words up.
Because
you're the Alexander Haig of our time.
I am. Actually,
the U.S. Secretary of State, famous in the 70s for making up words.
Conjuring up words. Yeah. I think that's a compliment, Sharad, especially from you. But children don't have a very strong view of what purpose should be between the ages of 0 and, say, 12, for example, right? And I'm being quite generous here. It all boils down to the parents, and it is really children's opinions and policies are shaped by what their parents believe in. And I'm not sure, I know Gina Zaman's obviously on the right side of the equation here, but I'm not sure that all parents and all grown-ups have the same concepts and ideals as all the rest of us.
I mean, it seems that, you know, one possibility is your child does not have any value system, and they kind of like limp along. They'll do whatever that you suggested to them. They don't have a strong sense of themselves or purpose. And then you have children who have a strong sense of purpose, but the purpose is directed at something like violent extremism. No, so which is the other thing. You want them to have a sense of purpose, but then
how many times have you seen children, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13 years old, holding, clutching Kalashnikovs in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, because that's what they've been told to do by their parents or their elders?
And not only that, or in that specific instances, they've been kidnapped at a very young age. They've essentially been brainwashed by the insurgents, and essentially they know no better. So really their views are shaped by the environment around them. And a lot of times, and we talk about how now there's a disconnect that the parents are not shaping the views of children as much as they should, and the burden is left on the teachers, really because of also our societal issues. A lot of families now, father and mother are working two jobs, trying to make ends meet. So the children are then left to fend for themselves. And so the traditional value-shaping mechanism that happens within the family is diminished somewhat, and therefore they're more prone to be influenced by negative elements.
But, you know, it's very, I think for me, it's complex on so many levels, including the fact that a lot of people get into routine, boring, dead-end jobs, right? And they don't feel a sense of excitement about life. And what a lot of these ideologies or organizations that have violence as part of their remit is that they promise adventure. And, you know, so much of popular culture is about adventure and excitement, this constant stimulation. And so there's a strange way in which popular culture might converge with these ideologies of violent extremism. I mean, look at some of the pictures. Everybody, you know, people are posing with these guns. There's a kind of machismo. There's a kind of, on the frontier, and I'm living an exciting life.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the secret of the secret sauce of the terrorist recruitment. I mean, it amazes me, but that's how they do it.
Well, also want to thank Prem Rai for jumping in on the question of that incentive for us to get rid of our old cars and buy new ones, and perhaps perhaps buy something that's more environmentally friendly. That conversation carries on. You can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.